Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 373. I'm in Norman, Oklahoma right now, and I had a super fun time for my University of Oklahoma last night, so thank you if you came out to that. People actually showed up, and everyone was super cool. We went and got pizza afterwards, so thank you, Oklahoma. I appreciate your hospitality. I'll be performing in Philadelphia June 27th, 28th, and 29th at Helium, and then in the fall, going back to Minneapolis to Acme, and then I believe Cobb's in San Francisco. In between that, we're doing our big show at the Balboa Theater the Saturday night of Comic-Con, and we've just had our guest confirmed, but I can't announce who it is yet, but it's a good one. So go to Nerdist.com/calendar to see dates and ticket links there. Also, starting Tuesdays, we're going to be doing practice shows for my Comedy Central show, which we are calling At Midnight, which is on Twitter. It's the symbol At Midnight is our Twitter handle. And so 6/25, June 25th, July 2nd, we're doing practice shows, and then we're taking the rest of July off for Comic-Con and Course of the Force, then picking up again Tuesdays in August and September. Go to nerdmeltla.com for the calendar there. Basically, At Midnight's just going to be like kind of like a rapid-fire comic roundtable social media mashup show. So it should be fun, and it's free. So come by if you're in the Los Angeles area, or make the trek out to Los Angeles, because you guys are going to help us figure out if the show's funny or not. We're going to discover it together. The idea was basically just to workshop the show a bunch so that by the time it goes on the air, it doesn't feel like, what are we doing? So join us, please. Your help is greatly appreciated. And I'd like to thank Audible.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. If you go to audible.com/nerdist, you're going to get a free audiobook download. Listen whenever, wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to, except they would be pre-written, organized thoughts, all put together, sentences that all are supposed to be one right after another. And if you've ever listened to an audiobook, you probably got it from audible.com and maybe didn't even realize it. They have over 100,000 titles to choose from, every genre. Audible's got you covered. Like our guest this episode, you could get your free book, could be Horton Hatches the Egg, narrated by Billy Crystal. So go to audible.com/nerdist, get your free audiobook download, and put some organized sentences in your brain via your ears. And now the episode, which, as I said, is Billy Crystal, who we were able to get thanks to Disney and our pal Dustin, who works at Disney. We all went up to Pixar, and myself and Matt Myra and the Nerdist News team, and Jonah, I believe, was on assignment. His assignment could have been his honeymoon, but I can't remember where he was. Anyway, it was Myra and myself. Got to tour the Pixar campus. We saw Monsters University, which is delightful and opens June 21st, and you should see it. But I got to take one of my favorite pictures that I've ever taken before. It's up on my Instagram, which is, the username's just Nerdist. But it's me in front of, they had a giant Pixar lamp, which was like their outdoor lighting in their courtyard. And I'm just looking up at the lamp, and I envision that's the last thing you see before you get crushed on the Pixar campus. So anyway, we had all that fun, and we still got to sit down with Billy Crystal. And he was fucking awesome. We've had a really good run of solid podcast guests lately. But Billy was great. He was super open, really sweet. There were no defenses up. He answered all of our questions and gave us so many wonderful details that were so satisfying to our comedy nerd molecules. So I will shut up now so you can enjoy the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 373, with Billy Crystal.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
So there's no real, this is very informal, we just talk, it's just like a conversation.
This is informal?
Yeah, it's very.
Can you believe it?
Shocked. Wow.
Have you been doing a lot of press today so far?
I did about 2 hours of international, yesterday I did 82 interviews in one day.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was a lot.
What's your favorite question? What is it like to play a mug?
Can you give your best scary face? What do you, that happened a lot.
Oh, you're kidding.
Come on, scare me. Yeah. And you know, I'm on camera, and I don't really want to do a scary face for you, lady. But it was okay. People were good.
No, please, just... Oh, gosh. Why don't you?
I know.
Why do they? Well, it's hard, you know, especially in the shorter formats. They're basically just looking for a sound bite. And so they just want, like, 30 seconds of something.
Yeah, and I want you to look silly.
the entire.
But they don't. But they mean very well, and they were all great, and they loved the movie, which is the best. When you do a junket and they like it, it's so much better.
How do you know?
You could feel it, and they're sincere, and they really liked it. And when you also know when they don't, because they'll start asking about other things and not the movie. So, Billy, the Yankees have enough pitching? Yeah, okay.
Well, should we talk about the movie? Yeah. It's a movie.
Obamacare.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what are you, what's your take?
Yeah.
How does this movie affect Obamacare?
Yeah.
I feel like there's no way I would ever expect you to remember this, but when Analyze This opened, one of the very first kind of interviews. What are you doing?
I was thinking to me to move.
Are you doing hand signs?
No.
Yeah. I just wanted to stick a little on that.
No, don't do it there. That's
a little higher.
A little higher. Have you ever done this?
So now you're right on the zipper.
I usually have people do this for me.
Oh, you bougie asshole.
Gorgeous.
We're good?
There you go. Gorgeous. I usually have people do this for me.
What?
Can we get Matt's sweatshirt steward?
Yeah. Please. Thank you. Anyone?
But I think it was like when Analyze This came out, they screened the film at UCLA, and you and Harold Ramis and Robert De Niro showed up.
Yes.
And I moderated that panel.
Oh, you did?
I did, and I was so nervous because you were great, and Harold Ramis described the last third of the movie to me because I didn't see it, and he was super animated, and it was like a movie pitch. And
are you going to tell me Mr. De Niro didn't talk a lot?
Mr. De Niro, not only did he not talk a lot, but you...
Shocking.
You totally saved it because... I had written what I thought were like, oh, I'm going to do some real sweet inside the actor studio Q&A here. And I hit him with some really pretentious, horrible question. He was just like, I don't know. And so out of panic, I go, well, what's your favorite cereal? And he didn't say anything. He didn't play along. And you just go, Cap'n Crunch, good night. And it totally, then everyone laughed, and then I felt okay, but he was not having it.
No, he doesn't, that's not what he likes to do. And we did several junkets for both movies, and he insisted that I always do it with him.
Sure.
Which I really enjoyed doing because it was like Burns and Allen. I would say, so Gracie, how's your brother? And I would talk. Gracie would talk forever, and that's what I was like. So we're in Paris, and it's for the sequel, and it's one after the other. And basically, I would just go on and on and try and be as funny as and informative as I could. And I'd look at him and go, "What do you think?" Yeah. That's pretty much it. That's pretty much it. And that would be it, right? So this woman from Finland comes in who looks like she's a woman from Finland because it gets dark at noon.
Sure.
Yeah. And so this untanned creature comes in looking so Diane Arbus-y sad. And she doesn't look up from her notes. And she says, the first movie you had a good time is the second movie. Would it be as good a time with the two of you? And Bob just looked at me and winked. He said, yeah, the second movie, you haven't seen it? He said, no, I haven't seen it. Okay, what? In the first movie, I said to him, if I talk to you and I go gay, I'm going to kill you. So in the second movie, I go gay and I track him down and I kill him. So she goes, really? And he goes, lady, move out of Finland. It was hilarious. Hilarious. But, some people like doing this and some people don't. And his work is on the screen, And he's gotten better. He tends to want to do more things. But he's a very bright and private guy and just joking around, which he'll do in private. He's really funny. He's great. But in these situations, he's not going to be as loquacious as you may sure. want.
I wonder if... Do you think that has to do with sometimes some actors are actors because they like being other people and they're just sort of weird. Like when you ask someone, be yourself, and they go, I don't know what that is. Do you feel like there's a little bit of that going on?
With him?
Yeah.
Oh, I just think he's a very private guy and he's an extraordinary artist and that's where he does his work. He doesn't like to talk about it.
Yeah,
Louis Armstrong, I think, said the best. He said, "If you asked me to talk about why jazz works, then I shouldn't be playing it."
Did you ever meet Lou? Did you ever meet?
Yeah,
you did. Because your dad was a jazz. Yeah. Your dad was.
And my uncle produced some of Louis's great records. Yeah,
Oh, wow.
So I knew most of those guys when I was young.
He was at a Seder. He was at a Passover Seder with us.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard him tell a story, and it's like, what the?
Yeah. No, pretty much. I was very fortunate that way. But it helped the funny come out. I dabbled in clarinet for a little while, but, you know, once I saw Woody play, I said, well, now I can't, because I you stole it from him. But the rhythms of being funny was really started with them because I could imitate them. You know, as a little kid who could, you know, do jazz riffs, you know, joking around with them, learning jokes from them, loved the music, still do. And so that's where it began.
Do you feel the rhythms of, like, improv and then improv jazz? Do they feel in your brain, do they feel like the same thing?
When you're working with a really good partner that way, yeah. Like Robin and I, off stage, in particular, have a real musical kind of thing going. And sometimes when we did Comic Relief together, we had some riffs that were really great. But our phone riffs, we talked about it about a month ago. We should do an album or just go in the studio and just go.
Yeah.
Because it's we get into a very dark, weird, great Derek and Clive kind of things. And it's really fun.
Yeah, it'd be really, I mean, that's essentially what a podcast is. It's like, oh, we might as well just record these conversations and make them available to people.
Yeah. And we've had some great ones. Usually after somebody famous dies. President Reagan passed away, and they opened the museum, and it was televised, big televised, right? Television's thing, and the 747 is hanging there, and this whole thing about Reagan. Phone. Hello. I see it's his. Bill? Hi, it's Ron. Oh, hi, Ron. How's everything? Well, you know, heaven's a lot hotter than I thought it was going to be. I said, hotter. Well, sir, you may not. This may not be heaven. Oh, well, that will explain why Nixon's balls are on the bridge of my nose. And we've just went on and on about that. And so, you know, I'm sorry if anyone's listening who is a fan of Ron. But, yeah, and that's where we'll go. And then several other famous people have died. And I know it's going to be the guy who died. And it's there have been some pretty great ones. Pretty great ones.
Oh, the death calls. It's perfect.
Oh, it's hilarious.
What's the permanent charge on that? Calling the other side.
Yeah.
I'm old enough that I remember watching soap when it was on, and I was a little kid, but I was a huge comedy nerd, and so my parents,
I had
no boundaries. Like they, you know,
that's great.
Every Steve Martin album, Richard Pryor, you know, soap, you know, your stuff. I remember you were on like that midnight special show.
Yeah.
And the thing that, and I just rewatched it again the other day.
Oh no!
what was fascinating to me about it is that it was. There was a really long. It was the joke about hormones and the
Yeah.
And like watching you on basically network television dance around.
Yeah.
Saying I have a huge boner, but still being able to get that idea across.
Yeah.
On television.
Yeah. I remember that very well. I still do it on occasion. I do.
Was it
funny?
Was it? Do you miss doing stand-up?
Sometimes I do. But I get great satisfaction when I do, and I'm going back to Broadway with my one-person show, 700 Sundays, which really incorporates a lot of some of that stuff into a real story about the jazz world, about my life growing up. And that's more satisfying than doing stand-up.
Yeah.
But I have a book coming out September 10th, which really started out to be material for a tour. I thought it would be fun to go back out. Because the show is very emotional, it's very funny, but it's also a play.
Yeah.
But to go out and play certain size kind of venue and get back out and say, this is where I started, this is what I do, you know, and I love doing it. And the more I wrote, the more they felt like essays. Yeah. And I said, this is maybe a book better than it is a stand-up, but if, you know, maybe both things could happen.
Yeah.
So I wrote like 9 or 10 chapters. It was right when I turned, you know, 65, and last March, and it just felt right. And then they sold it as a book. It's coming out September 10th. It's called Still Fooling Them, and
maybe sometime it might end up as a, something I could tour with also.
Oh, you totally could, especially because it, I think people kind of like those immersive experiences now where it's like you can read the book and then also you can see it perform live and yeah. you can see it, you know. I think it'd be really cool.
Yeah. So that's what so I do miss it on occasion and every once in a while I'm thrust into a situation that sort of becomes a stand-up kind of thing or just talking thing then that I didn't look for.
Yeah.
That just sort of pops out again.
Yeah.
Do you feel like when that happens, you're like, I wish I had the outlet of just going on stage and telling the story tonight?
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes, I could call the improv. I could be on at 10:40, but then you walk into that situation. You know, because it's so changed over the stand-up thing is so changed, watched and what people want to hear. It's very akin to what happens in the movie world too. What we get bombarded with movie wise, this feels like the same kind of subject matter is talked about over and over again.
Yeah, there's a few movies about the apocalypse this summer.
My God, how many times can we save this Earth? You've got 24 hours to save the Earth. It's
what?
Either it's an asteroid, a zombie, or something in a.
Or zombie asteroids. It's coming back.
Well, that's just sort of in the zeitgeist. But I think if you look at any generation, they all are like, this is the worst period of time that's ever happened.
I'm not saying
that.
I didn't say that at all.
No, I'm saying like that's where all these movies are coming from. Is that everyone thinks that it's just something that's in the air, but I think the reason everything feels as worse is because we're seeing all of the information on all of the world at all times. And there was a time when you didn't know what was going on, or you didn't know that people were dying everywhere. You didn't know that, and so there was a little bit of blissful ignorance that went along.
Yeah, I mean, I liked when we didn't know everything. I mean, I resisted this until recently, only because I have little kids, that I'm responsible for. So I hate the knowing everything. It's like, magicians shouldn't tell their tricks, and there are shows where they tell their tricks.
Yeah.
Or there's an app that'll say, all the trick. I want to know it's a trick. I want to figure it out for myself.
There's also an interesting thing that's going on with stand-up now where when you perform, someone can just either record your show or they can take jokes and then put them up and or if they didn't like something, they'd be like, hey, this comic's like it does not just stay in the room anymore.
No, there's no secrets. There's no secrets, and that sometimes keeps me from saying certain things in certain situations. I'm surprised I did the thing about Robin, but it's okay. he won't mind. Everything is everybody's business now.
Yeah, but when I think about all the comics that I was influenced by when I was growing up, and your stuff was, you were the guy who like had really performance based material. Like there were characters, and as opposed to just a lot of words.
Yeah.
So it seemed like it made sense to me. Like especially when you shifted to SNL or you went into acting, like oh yeah, of course, because that.
I always felt very at home in a theater. I always felt like I was an actor who could do stand up. Even though when I first started, I was just a pure stand-up guy. I always liked doing characters. I always liked doing. The first time I was on SNL, really on SNL, I did the old jazz guy.
Mm-hmm.
The piece was called Face. It was when Ron Nesson hosted the show. Who was President Ford's press secretary.
Was that the Can You Dig It? I knew that you could.
Yeah. And that was that hook and that thing. And then, it was always kind of. There were always sort of theatrical takes on whatever I did.
Yeah. That was a pretty stellar season of SNL. Or was it two seasons or one season?
One.
It was
just only season. 18 shows.
That's insane.
It feels like we were there for years.
Oh, I know.
Like it was you and Christopher Guest and Harry Shearer.
And Marty Short.
And Martin Short and Pamela Stevenson.
Yes.
Who later would become my therapist.
Yeah, did she really?
She was.
Wow.
Pretty
therapist.
She was, and she also, I've talked about this in the podcast before because she was married to Billy Connolly.
Yes, who's a great comedian.
Amazing. And so I was like, wow, here's a woman who was a comic. She understands me. She's married to a comic. And she did. She was great. And then she went to write a book, and I never saw her again. She's like, I'm on sabbatical. And I'm like, did I break this relationship? And then I never saw her again.
Yeah, we had a great year. For me, it was like the time of my life, and to work with all those guys and be in that studio is the greatest studio to work in. It's the Yankee Stadium of comedy venues,
yeah.
Studio 8H.
Studio.
It's yes, it, totally right. We had great fun.
I mean, it was
a lot of characters came out of that year.
Oh my God, so many. That's why you think it's like 2-3
well,
years.
Well, yeah, listen, I was 36. Chris is a little older than me by like a month. So we were old. I was 36. Marty's 2 years younger than I. So you had mid-30s guys who had a lot of experience. Marty was coming from SCTV, and you know, Chris and I had done so much stuff together, just as friends, and you know, and then you know, we were there, and our sensibilities were different. So we did a lot of film stuff that worked really well. And, you know, the synchronized swimming and the lifestyles of the relatives of the rich and famous. Chris and I did, I thought the best piece that he and I did was a piece called Ball Players, where we played two 75-plus-year-old Negro League baseball players in a really beautiful film.
I absolutely remember that.
Beautiful.
When they were doing that, the short films.
Yeah, but this was 8 minutes long.
Wow.
And we have 2 hours of stuff. And, you know... that was great. So, and the synchronized swimming was hilarious, and the Minkman brothers. And
the Minkmans,
then,
yeah.
And then live, you know, there was Ed Grimley, and it was the Fernando, and Jackie Rogers Jr. $100,000 jacket.
I was going to tell you, I still have on VHS tape, complete with the commercials from that time.
Wow.
I know that sketch back to front. And that was one of the first things I said to Pamela. I was like, you played Jackie Rogers. Oh, you also did the – you did the Dean Martin roast.
Excuse me, yeah. Yeah.
Was that – now, for years, I had always said –
I did
always,
two.
I'd remember – you could do the Muhammad Ali one.
I did Muhammad and I did Gabe Kaplan.
Well, I had always remembered
in the same afternoon. You would do one at two. It was at the MGM Grand in Vegas. You'd do one at two and another one at four. And they would just pluck the guy's caricature off and stick up the other one, and then that was it. He's the man of the week, you know.
Was there an audience there? Did they? Oh, there was. Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was in a big performing room with the Grand.
Oh, wow.
But sometimes, I remember Greg Garrison, who was the producer of those shows, who was Dean's producer, big Marine-type guy, scary guy. When he brought me in, I was 25 years old, something. He said... listen, it's going to go good, you know. But if you don't get a laugh, it doesn't matter. Because look who I cut to. And he had all of these tapes. Orson Welles will be laughing. Jimmy Walker will be laughing. Sinatra will be laughing. So, and then they did a pickup where Rickles wasn't even at the roast. But they shot him on an empty soundstage in Burbank from the waist up. And all in close-up at the same-looking podium. And he shot his in Burbank, and it was cut into the show in Vegas. Yeah.
That's amazing.
What did that experience – what did that feel like as a young comic? I mean, at that point, that's in the 70s. You're a young guy. You're a young stand-up. Yeah. And then here's all of these, you know.
Oh, it was great. I tell you, meeting Dean Martin was a really – that was a big deal. Because of Martin and Lewis. And because his variety show was one of the great variety shows. That Dean Martin show was one of the last personality – shows, a real beauty. He and Flip Wilson had really great variety shows when you could do that. And of course, you know, he was a very impressive looking guy. He was very handsome, and he was very Dean Martin. It was so old in the best way. This is going to sound terrible. I don't know. It was the best way. He was like a real old-time guy.
Yeah.
It was almost like meeting a great gangster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he had such charisma. And he was a terrific actor, you know. He sang. He was charming. But through the TV screen, people adored him. You know, they just trusted him.
Yeah.
He was very cool. And it was okay to be drunk. He was always talking about how drunk he was. Well, you know, it was amazing. Just think about it. Like in Johnny... Johnny was the superstar of all superstars. He and Ed would talk about their hangovers and their divorces for 30 years. And it was pretty. It was
and the time Ed got too drunk and came back to work.
Oh, my God. It's hilarious.
And they'd smoke
cigarettes.
Watch it, like, come back from commercials.
It was very cool. It was very cool.
And Rickles broke a cigarette box. Yeah, he had to go next door to CPO Sharky. And like,
all right. That was... You guys are nerds. Oh, man. You know too much.
We know a lot of stuff.
You're sort of like, you're very hip James Lipton type guys without the dark beard and the blue cards.
What is your favorite? Actually, I did really enjoy your Behind the Actor's Studio, because you said something as a comic that I'm still trying to figure out how to implement it even after, you know, 15 years. But when I saw it was something about, like, you know, as a performer, you leave a tip, like, yes, you leave, which essentially, like, you leave the audience something to take home with them, so yes, they remember you.
Yeah, it was advice I'd gotten from a amazing guy who was the head of our management firm named Jack Rollins, mm-hmm, who's still alive at 96 years old, who nurtured Woody Allen's career from a stand-up to a director. And he, along with Charlie Jaffe, were the producers of his shows and so on. And I was signed into their office. And I did a really hot set at Catch a Rising Star. Once I launched myself away from the two other guys I was with, because the group was called Three's Company, and I had to go on my own, and I already had a baby, and you know, I was 26, as if I better do this now if I'm doing it. And I did one night and at a college on my own, just like behind their back, and I felt like I was cheating on them, and it went great. And I went, fuck it, I'm going. And then I started to catch right, so, and I came, it's like, you know, like I just came out with like a vengeance of like, oh, and such enthusiasm. You know, not unlike Mike Wazowski in this movie. See, I have to work the movie.
Yeah, that worked out. It was great.
And, yeah. And I just wrote real fast, and I suddenly had 20 really good minutes, and Jack came in to see me. And I honestly killed. I just destroyed. I had stuff that was really strong, and I did great. So now I'm going to sit down with him afterwards for the first time to talk to Jack. And Jack's persona was, he was very much like an English professor at like Columbia or something. He had big bags and like Duke Ellington eye bags and tons of dandruff on his shoulders and sort of dour, but loved to laugh and very smart. And so, but I'm nervous. I'm sitting, you know, he's Woody's guy. And he said, "How'd you feel it went tonight?" And I said, the audience went great. And he went, "I didn't like it."
Oh, shit.
And that's inside, I'm going, I'm Norman Bates now. I'm stabbing him constantly. And
probably thinking, like, this fucking guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Because my thought was, he's going to say, "I'm not going to handle Woody anymore."
Right.
It's just going to be you. And he explained why. He said, "Listen, it all worked great. Audience loved it. But it was like Chinese food. It's really good, but you can't remember what you ate later. You didn't leave a tip." And he said, "You gotta. It's a little extra something that's you, that you leave with them. That even if it doesn't go as well, they know you when they leave. They'll say that. They'll know your name, and they'll go, 'That guy. You leave a little extra something, a little extra tip. Talk about you. I know what Ali thinks. I know what this guy thinks. I know what because I was doing a lot of impressions and what he referred to as toys and games."
Oh, wow!
And tomorrow night, we know this works, and you could make a lot of money going around just doing this stuff. Fine. But you're not going to get any better. So tomorrow night, don't do any of this material. And you never said the word "I" in any one of your sentences. "I feel," "I think." I want to know what you think. And be prepared to bomb. It's really important. Don't work so safe.
Oh, my God.
And it was like the best material ever. And then the next day I came in and I did exactly what he said. I bombed. But I was talking about, you know, I had a baby. Talk about that. You know, none of the comics were married or had kids. So that also set me apart a little bit. So now I'm talking about natural childbirth, which I did on an early television show, you know, in the 70s. That's what I was talking about, because that's what my life was like. And that made me better.
Wow, you're so lucky that you had that guy to
just
tell
that
you
moment.
That.
I've had, but all of them in the office who I'm still with, and one's sitting over there. But that stuff still comes up, and that's what I always achieve to. I listen to that, you know, is that. And then when I one of the managers is Larry Bresnahan sitting there, but his partner Buddy Moore was my main guy, and then he had me playing places where I shouldn't play. as well.
Like where?
Playboy clubs.
Oh, okay.
Around, which were like,
I remember when those were a thing.
Yeah,
like
but they
Chicago
were like
Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago, Denver, San Francisco, Atlanta, New York. They were all these places. They're all the same.
Yeah.
They were like McDonald's with tits. You know? And then, the comedian always closed the show. The singer did 20 minutes, and you did 20 minutes. And that was the show.
Oh, wow.
And they had dinner and the bunnies and that whole thing. And you did two or three shows a night. Weekend, you did five shows.
Holy shit.
And they usually had two performing rooms. So the singer would start the show upstairs. You'd follow him. He'd go downstairs and start the show downstairs. You'd follow him downstairs, walk on downstairs. He'd start the show upstairs. Then you'd follow him upstairs. And so that was a circuit that... mostly businessmen, sometimes with their wives or, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, when you're 26, 27 starting out, you know, wearing a sweater and jeans, that, you know, that's not the place for you.
Right.
But you had to learn muscle and how to reach them.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool, too.
I like to imagine that all those Playboy clubs, they just boarded up. And if you were to go to a skyscraper in Chicago, they'd open it up and just all these corpses would be inside. It's like these bunny ears. Because those were huge.
They
just like almost vanished.
But they paid very well. And you could do a week. You could do 10 days. Some were at resorts, like in Wisconsin. It was a ski lift. And I played in San Francisco. The Playboy Club here for a couple of weeks, and it was okay, but then I went into there was a great network of clubs. So there was a place called the Other End in New York, which was originally the Bitter End, which was the great place. That was a giant place, and Buddy booked me in there for 5 weeks. So I opened for everybody who came in, and I ended up headlining at the end of that because I got some nice notices and people started coming in. So that was cool. And then one night I'm on stage. This is a legendary stage there. It was really the first brick wall nightclub, you know, which always used to make me laugh when Bin Laden was in front of a wall. I said, well, he's at the Improv. And just go to the Improv in, you know, Pakistan.
He's leaving a tip. deadly tip.
Take care of your waitress and death to America.
I mean, take care of your waitress. Right.
And, when he bombed, he really bombed.
He really bombed.
And I'm on stage, and I see somebody in the back that sort of looks familiar as I'm working the stage. And it was a very wide room out to the sides and narrow in the front. And the people in the front sat in church pews. It was a really eclectic. Fred Weintraub, Paul Colby ran the place, and it was Dylan was there, and everyone was. It was a great place. And I see Bill Cosby standing in the back of the room. Well, Cosby was my guy. Still to this day, I think the best stand-up comic, definitely of his generation, along with George. Because they'd never stopped being who they were, you know, except Bill could act, you know, and did TV and stuff. And, of course, later the Huxtables and all that. But his early stuff, you know, I Spy and
of course.
He was great. But I related to him because he didn't do jokes. They were embedded in the story, in the smartness. And that was a bit – and there he is. You know, holy shit. You know, wow. And he came backstage – and was more than encouraging. Came back several times. We'd go out next door. There was a place called the Dugout next door, and we'd sit there. And for a long time, he would just come and sort of mentor me. And then it was great. And then I started doing, you know, we'd do the Tonight Show, do this and something. And then there'd be a phone message. Hey, it's Bill. You're just talking. I love it. Don't let him see your work.
Oh, my God.
Never let him see you work. And you're doing it. Take care. I hope to see you soon. Click. It was very cool.
And is that the thing that you think you took away from that the most was being able to...
Don't let him see your work.
Yeah.
And to... You work your jokes in, but don't let him see that they're jokes. So just let it be funny.
Yeah. Well, I guess it'd be the same as if you were doing close-up magic and they're like, oh, I see your card going in the thing there. It's gotta be seamless.
Yeah. And see, you know, I remember times when I would... watch him like in Vegas or something, and Bill would be on a tennis court until 5 to 8 till he'd go on. And he'd walk on with a towel around his neck and a sweatsuit and just sit down and start talking and have a glass of water. I mean, you know, I'd be in bed till 4 o'clock going, oh, what the joke, what's that opening line? You know, so until you go, trust it and just go out there and know where it is and do it.
Yeah. Well, that's happened a lot. I mean, because now I've been doing it long enough and I've seen comics that I know now and I've seen them all, I've seen a lot of them make that turn. Like with Louis C.K., he used to be a really great, he'd tell these really great weird scenario stories and he would come out with punchlines that you never saw coming. But when he started talking about his kids and his family and himself, like everything changed
And he's leaving a tip.
Yeah.
You know, it all just comes down to just tell the truth and just bend it a little bit.
And that's probably why one of the reasons why people like you hosting the Oscars is like, because you just seem like a guy that you're sort of on their, you're the audience, like you're basically on the audience side.
Well, when the good ones are when it would they feel like they're informal, even though it's a formal event, you try to make it as relaxed and just talk to them and don't feel like you're coming out as the jokey host. You work your jokes in, but be in command.
Yeah.
And I always, you know where you're going and try to be entertaining and then get out of the way.
Did you freak out the first time?
No, I was so ready the first time. I had done 3 Grammys. I had hosted the Grammys 3 times before the Oscars.
Yeah.
And we did a couple of comic reliefs, 3 or 4. So I was, when Gil Cates, who was a great guy, may rest in peace, asked me to do it, I was really ready. I had presented the year before, and it went really well. And I couldn't wait to get out there. I didn't freak out.
Well, it's hard, and I feel like they try to... They try to replicate you in the sense of like, oh, we'll put up one of their own and that'll lead them through. And it's like, yeah, but hosting is such a specific muscle. It's not just someone who's funny. It's not just someone who can act. Like, it is to lead an audience in that way is so specific, and they never really seem to figure that out.
Yeah, I don't know, I always felt pretty comfortable doing it and knowing your job and hoping to be entertaining. And, you know, and then we came up with new stuff that hosts hadn't done before, the films and the music and all of that stuff, to make it a performance, because most of the shows didn't have no more dance numbers in it. No, you know, the Oscars suffers from the fact that they have no performance stuff. It's not like the Grammys.
Yeah.
You know, here's a clip. Well, then do it live. Do the scene live.
Act it out.
You know, wouldn't that have been great to have like Brando and Rod Steiger do?
I mean, for an acting award, it kind of makes sense.
Come, they do it at the Tonys.
They should absolutely do it at the Tonys. They should absolutely. But film acting is also not theater acting.
No, it's
so
not at all.
So I think a lot of people are like, whoa, wait, what is this? Yeah. What is
that? Boy, they're not that good.
Wait, what?
He's nominated?
And then they do
now, so we would fill it with as much entertainment as we could.
Yeah.
You know.
And when you went back, did it feel like, oh, yeah, this, of course, this. Was it fun again?
Yeah. Some of it is. You know, But you know the show is what the show is. You come in with protect yourself the best you can and hope that you're funny and hope that the producers have a plan for the rest of the show that's going to be entertaining. The show's about moments. If moments happen, then it's a great show. You know, and the host always it's not a win-win thing, because you know if the show is good, it sort of was expected. It was good. And if it's not, then you get creamed.
Yeah.
Or they, you know, one year, was it the Lord of the Rings won everything. And they got upset. People got upset about the show. And you go, well, what? It won everything.
What do you want?
There were no surprises. It won everything. And it somehow became my problem.
Yeah, you know,
Jesus.
Yes, because as the mouthpiece of the show, you are responsible for every production aspect and every element.
Yeah, so, you know. So.
I think everyone takes it too seriously. Like, it's so serious. Like, the most serious thing in the world.
This last time, you know, with Seth and everything and the year before, like what I talked about before. It's so much scrutiny. Now, I don't know why anyone puts themselves in that position because it's so nasty.
Tina Fey was smart to be like, you're going to host the Oscars? She's like, no, why would I ever want to do that to myself?
And it's a shame. It's just too much scrutiny. After all,
there's too many outlets to complain about it now.
You bet.
Yeah. Don't you feel like a lot of them, if you read the reviews, you go, you wrote that before the show even came on.
Oh, yeah. You bet.
You were just going to be fucking mad about it no matter what
you
happened.
You bet. I think I faced some of that. And then there were certain writers that you go, oh, boy. Exactly. He wrote this 2 days ago.
Yeah, exactly.
He wrote this when it was announced I was going to do this.
He hadn't even seen anything yet.
He just left one spot to drop in a specific bit, and then he's done.
Yeah. And then, this is the first time I ever talked about it, so it is what it is, but you can't ever fight back to these people because then it's, whoa, he's so thin-skinned.
Yeah.
And you want to go, motherfucker, you just killed me in front of everybody, and you're wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it's your opinion, but, the whole job of a critic is a weird thing to me anyway.
It is weird, and I almost feel like when you read what critics write, and a lot of times I go, well, I don't know if you're actually the best qualified to write about this because your whole job is to pick things apart, and you don't have the same point of view that a random audience member would have who would just go and just want to be entertained. You're not going to see every little thing. You're not looking at the matrix code. So it kind of feels like it doesn't really represent how
people... No, it doesn't. It doesn't to me.
No. Does it feel different now than in... than like in the 80s?
Yes.
Okay.
No, because
there's
so many places for people to be upset with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes like something would air at night, and then newspaper already went to print. Sorry, we can't do anything about it. I'm like, forget it.
Or even when a movie comes out, and now it's just so hyper dissected. But you make a movie before, and it's like, people are like, they didn't like. Okay, all right. Well, I'm gonna make the next one.
Well, in the old days of, I have to sit now, boy. I'm gonna sound like a. In the old days. Prior to this time.
Just say in the 1900s.
Yeah, right. There were like two or three critics that in television that you would read. One of them was a very good one out here named Howard Rosenberg.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Who now teaches at USC, I found out. And the other was Tom Shales.
Tom Shales.
And then that was – I can't think of any others that were really – and now there's a couple hundred million of them.
It's ridiculous.
Anyone who can press send is now a critic, and you have to really steel yourself from the temptation to read the. I'll take a look at the.
Why do you think we do that?
I'll take a look at the comments.
Did I look?
And then you break out into the sweat.
We always refer to it as emotional cutting. it's like if you're going to do this, you're like, well, I'll just go. Why?
And then you read more.
I go, I'm having a pretty good day. How can I make this worse? The internet.
Maybe it'll get better. It didn't get better.
It really takes a lot of fun.
You don't know my mother. What is going on?
Oh my God, they really go.
Horrible.
They really go, man. These anonymous people who live in their parents' basements. They really
when
go.
Were there movies before that maybe some critics shit on that ended up becoming like When Harry Met Sally, like movies that are now just a part of like comedy movie canon?
Of other people's movies?
Yeah.
I don't know, boy, that's a good question.
I mean, are there anywhere where you can look back and go, ha, see, you were wrong.
Gee, I don't know. I don't know if I paid that much attention.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
I would have. I keep a detailed list.
You did, yeah.
No, I don't know.
Fuck you. City Slickers 2 was great.
I agree. It's a really funny movie.
I love both of them.
I want to with Harry Met Sally, was there a lot of improv on that? Do you like to improvise?
Yeah, there was a lot. There was a lot in rehearsal that ended up in the movie. And there was a lot... Rob was the best director, not only for that movie, but there was a time period where he just did one after the other that was just great.
Yeah.
The scene that was really every one of the scenes had improvisation in it, either in rehearsal that led into it. In the opening, when I first meet her, driving the grapes. There's a lot of outtakes of stuff like that. That was not planned. but the pepper scene was all improvised in the Temple of Dendur in the museum.
Oh, wow.
It was an idea I had when we got to the set that I'd been toying around with, that Harry's falling in love with her and he sort of doesn't know it, but he sort of does, and she really likes him, but they're not ready yet. And then when you start liking somebody, you have a silly voice that you do, or you do some little something ekes out. And so Rob said, try it. So I said, all right. And then I came up with this voice. I've decided I'm going to talk like this today. And pepper. I don't know why I said pepper. I don't know. It just felt like. But and then there's a moment where I say, but I'd be proud to partake of your pecan pie. where Meg looks off. You watch them. She looks off to Rob to go, no. She goes, no. I, and he goes, Meg. And so that became a very joyous.
Like a kid. No, get back out on stage.
Yeah. It became a very, you know, that was great about that set was Rob. Meg was tremendous. And very, so willing to, we knew we were doing something good, and Nora was there, of course, so it would be, you know, you'd get a nod of the head, and she'd redo it and hand it to you, we just would go, and it was a fabulous experience.
Right, having Nora Ephron live writing for you, okay, I'll fix it.
It was, you know, amazing. That was a beauty.
Wow. And do you want to... Do you feel like you want to keep sort of recapturing that, or can you not? Like, is it just sort of like, it just happened that way. We just got lucky that all the right people were in the right place.
You hope there are lightning bugs where on the next one that you can, you know, capture and put in a bottle so they glow for you, you know. But that, that doesn't happen all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I felt it on Parental Guidance with Bette that we had a really great kind of chemistry. And we did very well with, you know, the movie that surprised a lot of people, that it was as good
sneaky,
as it was.
Yeah, it was a sneaky good one, yeah.
Yeah.
So what they're wrapping it up in a sec, because I'm sure you still have like 9 more hours of press today, but just sort of...
I do.
You do.
And this is way longer than I thought it was going to be.
But it feels short, right?
No, because you're very good. You, on the other hand, I don't understand that,
Billy. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, fuck you, Matt.
Hey, I get it. You're like the live internet.
What's your favorite cereal?
Captain Crunch. But just sort of in closing, is it, you know, like what... What do you want to do?
But
next?
Wouldn't you like to hear De Niro in the kitchen in the morning?
Yes.
Hey! Who ate my Captain Crunch? No, that was mine. That was mine.
Well, I didn't know because when he asked you, you didn't say anything, so I didn't know.
I don't like the other stuff.
Well, there's Sugar Smacks.
Sugar. Not the same thing. And the Cocoa Puffs, no.
Well, you're not going to be upset at this. We're out of Rice Dream too. There's not any more rice milk.
Oh fuck!
I'm sorry.
What the fuck?
He's really mad.
You fuck.
You fuck. There's always something about just saying, you fuck.
Well, we saw Monsters University last night, and I loved seeing Mike Wazowski again, and I loved seeing the prequel, and of course...
It's a really good movie. They're really smart.
I will say the end scaring situation is terrifying in a great way.
Like, oh, yeah.
The end part is... I loved it.
And it's also very moving. It's because they're 18. It was such a great idea. You know, think about yourself making these choices about what you're going to do, where you're going to go. And Mike's that age. First of all, you have to call him Mike Wazowski. You can't call him Mike. No. And to me, the quiet moments are as powerful as dramatic moments in almost any movie I've been into. When those two guys are by the lake, when he realizes it's not going to be what he wanted it to be, and his friends supporting him. It's really kind of great. I love that they have room for that in this movie.
And you look great playing 18.
I did look good, didn't I?
Well, I know you got to wrap up. They had the figurines here outside, and they actually made them like the slimmer.
Yeah, it's a little slimmer, and he's got his hair is slightly different.
Yeah.
And the face work is great. You don't see any scars.
None.
And they're great people to work with.
Well, thanks, man. It was really it was absolutely a pleasure to meet you. And I hope that you do decide to do some touring later on.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Come back on when we need to promote the book.
The book is September 10th. I open on Broadway November 5th. This is a great year, you know, man. And then we'll see maybe in the spring.
Excellent.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you, guys.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Hey, this is my first podcast, ladies and gentlemen.
It's
not with Marc Maron.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.